In recent times, there has been a very commendable increase in interest in the writings of St. Gertrude the Great. She is, as Father Cyprian Vagagini has reminded us, a powerful reminder of the fact that there need be no sense of distinction, that is to say, no sense of disjunction between liturgical prayer on the one hand and personal piety on the other. Gertrude is a reminder of the fact that it is in the context of the liturgy that, especially for the monastic, especially for the monk or nun, a sense of nearness to the Lord happens. The liturgy is the place wherein we are trained for, and in a very real sense, we'll begin to experience the great graces of contemplative prayer. I've given several examples from Gertrude's writings, and several of these are examples that Father Cyprian Vagagini also emphasizes, and I cannot recommend too strongly his chapters on St. Gertrude in his book, The Theological Dimensions of the Liturgy, which has been out of print now for some years, but is available in most monastic libraries. The first text that I've given is a description of Gertrude's own, if you will, transformation. Her sense of how she was as a young nun brought into fervent relationship with the Lord. She says, she mentions in the section that precedes this, that she lived for a nun in a rather tepid fashion since having been given to the monastery as a child oblate in her youth. And then one day, she simply bowed to one of the older nuns, offered the gesture of reverence that was appropriate, and she looked up, and it wasn't the older nun she saw, it was Christ. She had a vision of the Lord that occurred simply because she had engaged in the act of obedience that offered, as St. Benedict says in the rule in chapter 72, that honor that we offer to one another, that honor which is offered in the spirit of, and in a very real sense, to Christ himself. Suddenly she saw that this was literally true. And she has this beautiful vision of Christ inviting her to enter into a deeper relationship with himself. And where does it all happen? If you read the text through, she discovers to her astonishment that the place where Christ invites her to experience this joy of relationship with himself is in her choir stall. It seemed to me that I was in the choir, in the corner where I usually said my tepid prayers. And it was here, of course, that she discovers that her relationship with Christ can become something more. I ought to mention that the pictures that I've included with these translations are from the monastery of St. Walburga in Eichstätt, and they are not from Gertrude's own time, they are from considerably after that, but they're illuminations by nuns, by women, who used the writings of St. Gertrude, were powerfully influenced by her and by the writings of St. Mechtild, and then put into visual form something of what they understood all of this to mean. And one of the recurrent images, which is found in Gertrude's writings and which also recurs here in these medieval illuminations, is the image of Christ's Sacred Heart, but the heart of Christ as a place wherein we dwell. We are invited into a union with Christ, as it were, like Christ who comes from the breast or the heart of the Father, like John the Evangelist who rests on the breast of the Lord. So we are in a mysterious way, and especially when we receive the Eucharist, invited into a union with Christ that can only be externally symbolized with the image of the heart, and the heart, as it were, as a place. Christ's heart is a place wherein we dwell with him. That's kind of an excursus or a diversion not contained within this initial text, but it explains something of the illumination with which the text concludes, and that is this this picture in the paragraph that begins, "From that hour, in a spirit of joyful serenity, I began to follow the sweet odor of your perfumes." The picture there is literally of the Eucharistic banquet in which the Blessed Trinity, the Father on the left and Christ on the right and the Holy Spirit as a dove, offering the nun, the chalice, is a kind of an external symbolic reminder of the fact that we are invited into this festal meal, this intimate relationship with the Lord, which includes our brothers and sisters. Notice that the nun's convent is included in the background. And where is this all happening? The border around it is the heart of Christ, the heart-shaped, literally, heart of Christ. The Eucharist is an intensely personal experience that somehow also reaches out to include the community, and it takes place within Christ's own embrace, here symbolized by the heart. The text from the Feast of Christmas, which is the next one down, is particularly beautiful because we see her meditating in a powerful way, using language and imagery that is unquestionably taken from the Rorate Caeli, that wonderful responsory, the image of the heavens melting and made sweet like honey and dropping down like dew. Meditating on this verse, she comes to understand more clearly what Christmas is about, and she uses astonishing language. She says, if you drop down, she hears Christ saying to her, you will receive in your deified soul the brightness of my divinity. This is a monastic, a woman monastic of the Middle Ages, who is recovering in the West the language of deification. And there's very possibly an allusion here to St. Benedict's own use of the language of deification, that we open our eyes to the deifying light, and perhaps also to the, which Benedict uses in the prologue and the references given there, and possibly also to the tradition of Benedict seeing the whole of creation gathered into a single ray. But here, for Gertrude, Christ is this light that deifies, that transforms us. The divinity of Christ makes us like the Lord. And this occurs as she meditates on an Advent and ultimately also on a Christmas antiphon. The Feast of Epiphany, the text is remarkable because we find that Gertrude describes herself as a place. She herself has this heart wherein not gold and frankincense and myrrh are offered to God, but actually the dark and distressing and problematic things in the world around her, what she describes as the sorrows and anxieties that creatures suffer through the depravities of their own weakness. This is something she gives to God like myrrh. The simulated sanctity of Pharisees and heretics she gives to God as incense. The impure and false affections, which is to say lust, of those around her she gives to God as precious gold. This is a beautiful reminder of how the liturgy can enable us to find within ourselves, within our own deepest core, a place where God works a kind of alchemy. And the language of medieval alchemy is used here, the idea of transformation like gold in a crucible. This is an allegorical, a symbolic way of saying within us who pray, there is the offering to God of the whole of creation, including the dark aspects, which God will make into something holy and glorious. And then the last text on the Feast of the Trinity, if you go on to look at it, includes a specific reference to the heart of Christ. And I've given a picture at the very bottom, which is rather beautiful, that shows this ascending ladder of virtues that leads into the heart of Christ, where again there is this kind of Eucharistic banquet, an external visible depiction of an inward spirituality nourished by and expressed in the liturgy. It is in liturgical prayer that this kind of vivid sense of Christ's transforming power, his deifying power, is experienced and then shared with the world. And as we'll see, the modern expression of this is to be found in the language of the royal priesthood that we find in the Second Vatican Council, with which we'll conclude this section.